Have you ever wondered what Amsterdam is all about? Don't just read about the culture that has accepted cannabis. Experience it firsthand with CS Travel's Sensible Amsterdam Tour with Normal. Travel to one of Europe's most beautiful cities this January for an educational and recreational visit to a city that regulates cannabis like alcohol. CS Travel has arranged an exclusive visit for reform-minded Americans that includes a private tour of some of Amsterdam's most renowned coffee shops, educational seminars with coffee shop proprietors, local law enforcement, members of the Cannabis Retailers Association, and Normal staff. Entertainment includes a special evening at the Boom Chicago Comedy Club, canal tours, visits to the city's many museums, including the world-famous Van Gogh Museum. Don't just wonder about Amsterdam, experience the beauty and freedom of this unique city firsthand with CS Travel and Normal Sensible Amsterdam Tour. Pricing information is available online at coffeeshoptravel.com. That's coffeeshoptravel.com. Or call toll-free at 800-816-1846. That's 800-816-1846. Be a sensible American. Visit Amsterdam with CS Travel and Normal this January. Call 1-800-816-1846 right now to book your trip. More information is available at normal.org. Distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. This is your daily audio stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Welcome to the most popular audio podcast regarding marijuana in all of America and all the world, featuring interviews with scientists, politicians, doctors, prohibition policy activists, regular cannabis consumers, musicians, and Normal staff and Normal's board of directors, along with music and comedy no other podcast can offer. You can always find out more about the show at our website, normalaudiostash.com. We're ending marijuana prohibition with education, one listener at a time. Welcome back here to the Audio Stash today. It's Wednesday, November 14th. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Take a moment to join us at Normal. Help us end marijuana prohibition in America. Just visit NORML.org to make your donation or join Normal today. Folks, we also have direct donation links right up on our website every day at normalaudiostash.com. In our program today, we're going to speak with Bernie Ellis in Tennessee. Bernie's been on the program here before. There was a benefit concert for him in Nashville earlier this year, and Bernie was testifying at the Tennessee State House yesterday. We're going to talk with Bernie about his testimony and what's happening there in Tennessee concerning medical marijuana. Also in our program today, our regular Wednesday segment with Dr. Mitch Earlywine talking about cannabis science. And today we're going to look at teens and cannabis use, a new study that was highlighted in the Normal News weekly press release last week. Kind of broke down some of those stereotypes concerning teens who only use cannabis. The study was conducted in Switzerland. We'll revisit that weekly press release story today right before we talk with Mitch. Let's get things started today by heading down to Tennessee.
I was raised in the North, but I got something down in my soul.
The Tennessee House Health and Human Resource Committee held a four-hour hearing yesterday on reestablishing medical marijuana in the state. Among those presenting testimony at the hearing in favor of medical marijuana were Normal Board of Directors member and local Tennessean Paul Kuhn and a local Tennessee medical marijuana activist, Bernie Ellis. Bernie joined us via phone earlier today to discuss the hearing. Bernie, welcome back here to the Audio Stash.
Chris, good to be back with you.
Great to speak with you today, Bernie. Now, tell us about this subcommittee hearing. What was going on with medical marijuana there?
Well, the Tennessee House Health and Human Resources Committee has a bill before it to reestablish Tennessee's medical marijuana program. Back in April, one of the subcommittees of that full committee voted out favorably a medical marijuana bill, and so this was an opportunity to speak before the entire committee to encourage them to put the bill out for a full House debate and vote.
There was some opposition who showed up at this hearing, including David Murray, who came all the way from his office at the Office of National Drug Control Policy in Washington. They presented some of the standard and fairly outdated and flat wrong prohibitionist rhetoric.
Well, there was some opposition. That's correct. Dr. Murray was there. We had a gentleman from New York whose child died of an OxyContin overdose. I'm not sure what his experience was that was relevant to the debate, and neither our legislators had the same question. But we did have opposition. Fortunately, only one of the people who spoke in opposition was a local Nashvillean, and he actually gave a sort of an equivocal statement. He was not completely against cannabis for medical research. Fortunately, all of the people who spoke in opposition spoke first, which allowed the four of us who spoke in favor of the bill to leave the last impressions, I guess, on our legislators. And the legislators paid considerable attention, asked excellent questions, and we believe there is a lot of support on this committee to move the bill forward.
Now, Bernie, you've been in the field of public health for many years, and you have a lot of experience dealing with state elected officials. So what points did you try and hit on in your own presentation?
Well, you know, fortunately, I was one of the last people to speak, and I said, you know, our opponents have been all over the map on this issue today. Let's focus back in on medical cannabis. The key issues from my perspective are, have we proven its efficacy, that it actually does help with serious medical conditions? Have we proven its safety? Is it better than the synthetic THC pill Marinol? Does it have any impact on the illicit market? And by just covering those points one after another, the several legislators basically said it's good for you to bring us back to the key issues we should be talking about. I think they did respond favorably to the overwhelming evidence of medical utility. And they responded, you know, to the fact that this is the safest therapeutically active substance known to man. Fortunately, we can thank the DEA for that quote, not ourselves. And again, there's plenty of evidence that there's been no increase in illicit marijuana use in states which have passed medical marijuana bills. So we do have the facts on our side.
Righto. You mentioned the interest of the legislators and having them ask some good questions. What are these state elected officials interested in when looking at the issue of medical marijuana?
Well, I think that there are a couple of issues they're interested in. You know, the first and foremost two issues are, is there evidence that medical marijuana does benefit patients? And secondly, is it a safe alternative? And again, I think we reviewed those issues in detail. I think on the other side, there is some concern about, you know, does passing a medical marijuana bill send the wrong message to youth, or that tends to be a key phrase they use a lot. And of course, we were able to say, you know, we have a double standard in place in this country that treats marijuana differently than every other legal and illegal substance. And if we applied the same concerns, we would be a pretty puritanical society with alcohol outlawed, tobacco outlawed, all pharmaceutical drugs that have a psychoactive effect outlawed. All we're asking is that we apply the same rules to medical cannabis that we do to everything else. One point that really struck home with the legislators, one of the last slides I showed reviewed some of the promising research evidence coming out of Spain and Israel in the last 2 years, discussing laboratory evidence that elements in cannabis actually attack and kill cancer cells in five different cancer categories. And the legislators really picked up on that, and then I showed them a quote from a 1975 Medical College of Virginia study that came to exactly the same conclusion, that components in cannabis actually kill cancer cells, and was able to share with the committee that the DEA and NIH defunded that research and prohibited any further U.S. research on cannabis's role as a cancer cure. I told the legislative committee, you know, if we've been sitting on evidence for 32 years that cannabis can actually serve as an effective cancer treatment, not just as a palliative to reduce nausea and pain, but actually attack and kill cancer cells, it is immoral to have sat on that information for 32 years. And I think the legislature responded positively to that.
Well, Bernie, I know you've got to head out now, and we're going to speak again later this week. Many thanks for taking time to speak with us about the hearing today.
Well, Chris, thanks for the opportunity. And folks, if we never stop fighting, we cannot lose.
Thank you again for joining us today, Bernie. Bernie Ellis there, a medical marijuana activist in Tennessee and a true inspiration with his work and efforts there. We'll have more information, perhaps some audio from those Tennessee hearings in upcoming episodes here on Normal's Daily Audio Stash. Stay tuned, our cannabis science segment coming up next.
What's up, y'all? This is Soja, and you are right now listening to Normal's Daily Audio Stash. Big up yourself.
In just a moment, we're going to get to our interview with Dr. Mitch Earlywine. He's here every week for our cannabis science segment on Wednesdays. Before we do, Mitch and I are going to discuss in depth a story that was released last week in the Normal News weekly press release in text and audio about teens and marijuana use. So before we get to our interview with Mitch today, let's read the whole story. This from Lausanne, Switzerland. Teen pot use not associated with psychosocial problems, study says. Teens who use cannabis do not report more frequent psychosocial problems compared to young people who abstain from the drug, according to survey data published this month in the journal Archives of Pediatrics and Adolescent Medicine. Investigators at the University of Lausanne in Switzerland analyzed survey data from over 5,200 students age 16 to 20. Of these, 455 subjects reported using only cannabis. 1,703 subjects reported using both cannabis and tobacco, and 3,105 subjects said that they abstained from both drugs. Compared to those subjects who reported using both substances, cannabis-only youth were more likely to receive good grades, play sports, and live with both parents. Cannabis-only youth were also less likely to have been drunk in the past 30 days or have used other illegal drugs. Compared to those subjects who abstained from pot and tobacco, teens who reported using cannabis only were more likely to participate in sports and have a good relationship with friends. Cannabis-only youth received similar grades compared to those who did not smoke pot, but were more likely to report having skipped class. Youth who abstained from pot were more likely to report having a strong relationship with their parents. However, cannabis-only youth did not report suffering from higher rates of depression. Investigators concluded, quote, cannabis-only adolescents show better functioning than those who use tobacco. Compared with abstainers, they are more socially driven and do not seem to have psychosocial problems at a higher rate. More information about this story is available online. We have a link at normalaudiostash.com. Full text of the study, Characteristics of Cannabis Users Who Have Never Smoked Tobacco, appears in the Archives of Pediatrics and Adolescent Medicine. And this is the story we're going to focus on in our Cannabis Science segment today. Each Wednesday, we get the chance to talk about the science of cannabis with Dr. Mitch Earlywine. Mitch is professor of psychology at the State University of New York at Albany. He's author of Understanding Marijuana, A New Look at the Scientific Evidence, editor of Pot Politics, and he's got a new book coming out this spring called A Parent's Guide to Marijuana. You can also catch a monthly column by Mitch in High Times magazine. Mitch, welcome back here to the show today.
Oh, thanks so much.
Wonderful to speak with you again this week, as always, Mitch. Today we're going to address the issue of teens using marijuana. And there was that very interesting study we just read and reported on in Normal News last week that broke some of those stereotypes associated with teen cannabis use. So the study found that teens who used cannabis and not tobacco, again, more likely to play sports and have a good parental relationship, and cannabis-only use was not seen to have any social decline on these particular teens.
This is a really intriguing study, and anytime I see something that says there aren't any negative effects, I often think, oh, maybe the sample was too small and that's why they couldn't detect them. But we've got over 5,000 respondents in this survey, so clearly it's not just that the sample is too small. And then it basically turned out that the folks who are using marijuana and tobacco are the ones who are worst off, whereas folks who use cannabis and don't use tobacco are ones who actually are showing markedly less use of hard drugs or drinking to intoxication, as well as plenty of extracurricular activities and nice warm feelings about their relationships with both their friends and their families. It's a wonderful finding on its own, and you know, still we want to harp on the idea that cannabis use is really not for kids, but it's kind of reassuring to understand that particularly in the absence of tobacco, intermittent experimentation with marijuana at a young age doesn't seem to be anywhere near as detrimental as some media sources have tried to lead us to believe.
Now, Mitch, here in the United States, we do know that teens use cannabis at a pretty high rate. About 50% of teens say they will have tried cannabis in high school here in America, with about 20% being classed as regular cannabis users. So we know U.S. teens are indeed smoking pot, but you know, how should we approach the educational aspect here and try and perhaps get those numbers down? Is cannabis more like the subject of sex than it is like alcohol or other drugs when we're dealing with teen use?
I think it's a lot like any kind of experimentation that folks have in the teenage years when you're figuring out who you are and what you want to do with life. So I would be curious about, you know, questions about trying different religious beliefs and experimenting with different activities and trying out new sports. I mean, it's really just part of figuring out who you are. And I want to emphasize, too, that in this sample, the folks who smoked cannabis and not tobacco weren't using particularly often at all. It wasn't like these were regular users. And when we see the data suggesting that half of high school students have tried cannabis, often it's really only one time. So the notion that regular cannabis use is a part of teen life is not true at all. Nevertheless, a mild experimentation is nothing to suddenly throw a teen into an inpatient treatment ward over.
And do you think that this type of outreach and education is being hindered by parents and schools who are essentially being zero tolerant towards any experimentation?
Unfortunately, particularly given some of the hype we've gotten about, oh, increased potency will drive you crazy immediately and stuff like that. And, you know, I've said time and again, the heavy users early in life do run into a whole lot of troubles that they wouldn't have if they could just wait until their brains are more developed and wait until they're, you know, just basically more ready. But this intermittent use or, infrequent experimentation is nothing to drive yourself nuts about. I think the concern and the message that we have time and again on the Normal website and in all our presentations is this really isn't part of teen life because we don't want to see the increased risk for dependence. There are data suggesting a small decrease in IQ and some deviant brainwave development in heavy users early in life, and of course nobody wants to see that happen. The other big negative consequence we've harped on time and again is the legal consequences for teens are just so outrageous, particularly given the potential to, you know, lose financial aid in college over a drug-related arrest, which just, you know, drives me completely insane. But obviously, with all these things in mind, we still don't see an outrageous set of negative consequences with experimenting with cannabis early in life, particularly among those who don't use tobacco.
Now, Mitch, why is tobacco use such a tell on kids maybe having some other social issues? Is it that kids express some of their angst and attitudes through smoking cigarettes, or is there something about nicotine and smoking that physically lead to these psychosocial problems?
It's funny because I think it is more of that marker. Years ago, a guy named Jesser put out the idea of problem behavior theory. And the idea was that there's a subset of folks who do a whole bunch of different deviant things, and cigarette smoking is just a marker of those. They're also less likely to wear their seatbelts. They're more likely to drink to intoxication. They're more likely to have unsafe or unprotected sex. And all these things seem to go together as part of this disinhibited personality, if you will. And I'm finding that it's not tobacco or nicotine per se that is creating these problems. This is just one indicator of this whole set of troubled behaviors. And, you know, I don't think, despite what these data might suggest, that nicotine is somehow leading folks into outrageous pathways and all these troubles. It's just that it's a marker of some of these other disinhibited behaviors.
And in discussing tobacco, you know, it's actually a bit harder for teens to obtain tobacco than it is for them to obtain cannabis. In the U.S. and Europe, there are pretty strict controls in place for tobacco sales, so kids who do choose to smoke cigarettes really have to work hard to obtain them in the regulated market.
And in fact, that may be a sign of this sensation-seeking personality, if you will. So anybody who's willing to go through all the trouble they have to go to in order to get cigarettes underage, obviously may be also willing to engage in a whole bunch of other behaviors that seem to be problematic. And, you know, I'm not trying to blame them as people, but I'm just saying this is a sign of a potential need for intervention early on. And, you know, I love, actually, you know, as much as I make fun of the DARE program, some of the school-based anti-tobacco programs have been quite successful. Steve Sussman has one out at University of Southern California that shows that, you know, once people really understand the health consequences of smoking and realize that not all their peers are using cigarettes, they're much less likely to use cigarettes regularly themselves.
In talking to teens about cannabis, adults tend to approach this through a purely intellectual path, but teens really approach it from a variety of areas, including emotional. So how do we balance being honest with teens, not scaring them or lying to them, and also making sure that should they experiment, they don't end up being problem users?
As you can imagine, I detail this in the Parents Guide to Marijuana that High Times is publishing, and my take-home message is always listen first and ask questions later. So quite literally, you know, teens tell me adults listen with their mouths open, that they just can't get an adult to pay attention to them or to hear what they're saying. And if you're willing to say, tell me about marijuana use in your school, and actually listen and nod your head and repeat back to them the things that they've said so they understand that you understand without jumping in and saying how evil and horrible and how you don't want them to do it is right away. And then if you ask questions, literally, what do you think about that? How do you feel about that? What have your experiences been like? It's stunning how eager they are to open up. They're really hungry to make this connection on any topic, and this topic in particular, where they're accustomed to just being berated, they love the opportunity to engage in this behavior and actually give their own opinions and let you know what they really think. Then if you're willing to dispute the myths, to point out all the things that, you know, we know are false, that they don't believe anyway, there's no gateway effect, there is no amotivational syndrome, there's none of this, it's going to make you crazy and you're going to end up with a needle in your arm in the gutter somewhere, they like to hear that you don't think that stuff either. And then you've increased your credibility. So when you do point out, look, we've got data showing that the rates of dependence are higher the earlier you start in life. We've got data suggesting that brain changes that are essential to adolescent development get interrupted in odd ways with heavy use of marijuana early in life. And we have at least one longitudinal study suggesting IQ points dropping in folks who use heavily early in life. Then they believe that in part because you've already pointed out the lies that they heard in previous programs really are lies. And then, again, you have to ask again and listen again and find out what are their reactions to this under those circumstances. But it's really part of the whole relationship in a whole bunch of different domains, not just let me sit down and have one lecture about marijuana one time.
Now, is that also an issue with parents and schools and how they approach this dialogue with teens, that there is some one-time set aside to talk about pot rather than an ongoing conversation?
I mean, Chris, as you know, parenting is the most difficult job around. And in truth, if we're candid about our own apprehensions, discomfort, anxiety, and worry, it's stunning how teens will step up to the plate. So there are times when you literally have to say, look, I just don't want you to do this because I'm anxious and crazy. I'm nuts about this. It scares me to no end, the thought of you becoming marijuana dependent. Please help me with this. Let's be a team. Let's work together. And suddenly, instead of you telling them what to do, it's you and I are on the same team here. We both want you to have a wonderful life. Let's talk about how to work that out. And I think they really like that. They like to have the responsibility, and they like to be treated in such an adult way. And then it really gives them the opportunity to show all their skills.
Mitch, another aspect to this is cannabis use within the family. There was a woman at the Normal Conference who was up in her 80s. She had written a booklet called I Smoke Pot with My Family. What about that aspect, especially between older parents and their adult children? Can smoking together help or hinder that relationship?
It's interesting, and I certainly don't want to out anyone in my own family, but there are generally families that now have literally three generations of cannabis users, and I think the opportunity is there to model responsible use. I do not think this is something that should be done in front of kids. I don't think it's something that should be made a big deal of in front of kids either. And yet when, you know, folks reach 21 or an acceptable age, I don't feel like it's fair for, you know, one person to have to go hide their pot use in one part of the house while another person is hiding his or hers in another part of the house. And I think, again, by beginning these conversations early in life, there'll be the opportunity to connect on this. The idea that using cannabis as part of a family freaks people out in this country so much, and yet it is often the modal situation among experienced cannabis users, particularly as the baby boomers are getting later in life. And I think the chance is there to say, here are the informal rules I've developed for myself. You'll notice I do not get high in the morning. I do not get high before I drive. I do not get high if I've got a whole lot of work to do. And I just don't get high automatically. I tend to make a special event of it. I try to do it infrequently, but then really in a situation where I know I'm going to enjoy it and have it be a special thing. And moreover, this is not my only recreational skill. I like to exercise, I like to read, I like to do, you know, all these other things. And then suddenly it's just one activity among a whole list of activities, and that's a way to have it fit into a healthy lifestyle, as opposed to some of these hidden alternative crazy things where people find out years later that, you know, one of their siblings has been smoking all along and actually didn't have any guidelines, didn't have anybody to sort of show them how to use it in a non-problematic way, and does end up running into more trouble than was probably necessary.
Now, Mitch, we're talking about teens and cannabis today, but our conversation has brought up an interesting issue for me here. Do you think that because of prohibition and the fact that there are generations now of experienced cannabis consumers who do so very well hide their use, that there is this kind of preset list of behaviors that cannabis consumers fall into today?
Well, we've seen this in a number of situations where anytime something has to become a secret, some of the skills that might be associated with it tend to disappear as well. We've seen it in underground religious observance. We've seen it in all kinds of things that have ever been stifled. I really want to commend people like Chris Conrad and Mickey Norris, who, you know, have flyers about responsible cannabis use, wear the pins and point out the buttons and say, look, this is just part of life, and you're still a wonderful person. And under these circumstances, now when it's out, we can really talk about ways to do this in a good way. We've got wonderful guides from alcohol, people who use alcohol in religious settings, people who drink with their family responsibly are often buffered against the negative consequences of alcohol, in part because they have experience and modeling for how it can be done in a non-problematic way. I see no reason why cannabis shouldn't be the same way, but right now that idea is a really hot and scary sort of third rail, if you will, and we begin with talking about it.
Well, Mitch, this conversation today, as always, has been very fascinating. I really appreciate you taking time to join us every Wednesday here on the Audio Stash.
Oh, I'm glad to be here.
Thank you again, Mitch. Dr. Mitch Earlywine is professor of psychology at the State University of New York. He is author of Understanding Marijuana, A New Look at the Scientific Evidence, editor of Pot Politics, and his new book, A Parent's Guide to Marijuana, is coming out this spring. You can catch a monthly column by Mitch in High Times magazine. And again, he joins us each Wednesday here on the program for our Cannabis Science segment.
You're listening to Normal's Daily Audio Stash.
Wanna know my favorite color of the rainbow? There's only one for me. The only color in the world that makes my day go like a dream. Green, I like green. Green, give me green. When I think of all the colors in my rainbow, there's only one for me. It's not a red, a blue, an orange, or a yellow. My rainbow's green. I like green. Green. Give me green. I am green.
You're listening to Pod Safe Music on Normal's Daily Audio Stash.
You've been listening to Normal's Daily Audio Stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Make sure you visit our website at normalaudiostash.com. That's normalaudiostash.com for more information about every day's show. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Thanks for listening today. See you at 4:20 tomorrow. Podcasting technology of Normal is made possible by Red Aphid Interactive Media. More information at redaphid.com.